The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Again, I must say the chanting feels really strong. Thich Nhat Hanh used to say the future Buddha is the Sangha. It's not one singular person, but it's a collective. The Maitreya Buddha is the Buddha of the future. It's what all of us are doing. So I could feel that this morning. I got a little chills and a little teary right now. It's so strong in this renewal of vows ceremony, both our own and together as a collective, the harmful karma that we've created, harmful actions. And I also wanted to bring in some aspect of the question of what is sacred, our sacred life, what is sacredness, treating things with respect, treating ourself with respect, and creating sacred space is what we're doing, a respectful space together. This ceremony, primarily Fusatsu, renewal of vows, sometimes translated as continuous, good, wholesome practice, rather than ceasing from unwholesome action, is what we're renewing. Gives us a chance to atone, to be at one, not separate from any, whatever kinds of harmful separation we have created by me. If you haven't noticed, Zen liturgy is very direct. We don't look over there. It's created by me since of old, and to recommit to practicing good, actualizing good for others, be guided by the precepts, the moral and ethical teachings, to live in harmony with our nature. And these precepts aren't fixed. They're seen from different perspectives, but from a Mahayana perspective, they're very open and in accord with time. What time is it? What's our place in what's happening? What's our position? What's the circumstance? So at one moment, something might be the right thing to do, and in the next moment, totally wrong. So we have to be in accord with what the circumstances are, and it's all to save life, to be of benefit. But we also need to recognize that as human beings, there's always some harm that is being created, all the time. Just because we have to live, we have to eat, we have to have shelter, and we have to have food and clothing. And this is all in some ways harming something so that we can have life. But this has to be kept, of course, in balance. So this ceremony goes back to the time of the Buddha. I'm not going to go into that too much, where he would gather his community on the full moon and everyone would look at the precepts and say out loud to each other where one transgressed, where we broke a precept. Can you imagine? We all went around today. And the precepts that we have, the 10, we have 16 in our tradition, in the Zen tradition. And every religion has sort of these moral and ethical guidelines, which can seem very similar, but Buddhism is based on no non-self. It's non-theistic. So there's nothing, you know, how might we be guided when there's no external person or thing that demands us to be a certain way? There's no God who is judging. That's all based on our own human experience. And from a Buddhist perspective, actions are both good in a relative world, both good and bad have consequences. And these consequences shape our future experience in a concept known as karma. And they also go backwards, so they can affect what has happened. It's all happening now. There's only now. There's only this moment. But how we understand the past affects what we will act in the future only now, because we're in this moving, unfixed momentariness of our life. That's what our life is. We have this body, and it's changing, and it's just seeing into the aggregates, into the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, that they're all not fixed. So our 16 precepts begin with three refuges in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then there's the three pure precepts, not creating evil or harm, practicing good, and actualizing good for others. And then the 10 grave precepts is how to do that, to be affirming of life, not kill life, to be giving, to not steal. This is how it's phrased in our tradition. Honor the body, do not misuse sexuality, manifest truth, do not lie. Proceed clearly, do not cloud the mind. See the perfection. Don't speak of others' errors and faults. Realize self and other as one. Don't elevate yourself and blame others. Give generously, don't be withholding. Do not be withholding. Actualize harmony, do not be angry. And experience the intimacy of things. Don't defile the three treasures. So all of the precepts are about living the life of a Buddha. Not about how to be good and live by the precepts, but rather to help us and challenge us in a way to examine who we are as killers. Who we are as stealers, as misusers of sexuality, as liars, as addicts of intoxicants, as blamers, misers, angry people, abusers of the three treasures. So if we look deep enough, we can see we are not separate, that we have all of that potential within us. And if you have the Buddhist perspective of karma, we might say we've done this hundreds of thousands of times before. In some way, we know this. We know this. So Buddha realized there is non-self, and the precepts are based on this non-self as the basis, as the fundamental, that there's that emptiness of all the conditions. He said, the word karma simply means intentional action. This relationship between what we choose to do and then what we make of ourselves. How we shape ourselves and are shaped by ourselves through action, moment to moment, by this coming together as this. Right now, there's all these causes and conditions that form each of us, but it's moving. It's not fixed. But I manifest as a Hojin, as a blessing, and here we are. And this is not fixed. It's constantly, it's in a process of movement. And it's a very, and all of that is born of my body, from my consciousness, from my body, my mouth, my thought. So it's a very open system. And then this future setup of our karma will be either skillful or unskillful. What we will inherit further downstream in the flow of our consciousness. And we can't always see that. So this principle of cause and effect is the centerpiece of the Buddhist teaching. And many teachers say, just understand cause and effect. Just understand karma. So there's a lot that we can look at here. This is a ceremony. And I want to just say again what Mizumi Roshi, Daido's teacher, speaks about on what ceremonial action is. He says this word ceremony, karamonia, is related to cura, meaning cure, the act of healing or being healed. In other words, ceremony is an act that cures or heals, or by which something is healed. In having a ceremony or in doing ceremonial action, we must ask, what is healed by what? What is healed by what? He says the definition of ceremony also includes the word law, the laws of life. From morning until night, our life is continuous ritual, governed by rules, regulations, and laws. Behaving informally, can we follow the laws or regulations that are essential to living a healthy life? He says the word heal means be healthy, be whole and sound. Make our life healthy is ceremonial. So in renewal of vows, we're making our life wholesome and healthy again by freshening the direction we want to live in. That's healing. That's ceremony. And we have these rituals, these things we're doing. And he says, don't think rituals that far away. We're constantly, our lives are full of ritual. As I said, some people say, oh, there's too much ritual in Zen. But when we look at it, it's happening all the time from the moment we get up and put our feet on the floor and take our shower and make our coffee and brush our teeth and wash our face and eat. Going about these simple things in an orderly way. That's ritual. So when we do this with others, as the Buddha did, we build sacred trust in community. Because others help us see our blind spots. We can't do it alone, right? We know that others help us see our blind spots. They inform us in one way or another what our actions are doing and how they're landing. So I wanted to look at today, the first pure precept, a little deeper, not creating evil, not creating harm. And in some ways, I could say, period, end of suffering. Don't do it. Don't make more harm. We're already acknowledging we do. And we have. But don't create harm. So in a sense, I think these precepts are the highest art practice to be conscious of our actions, what we're creating. We need to acknowledge we're always creating harm just by living in this sacred body, on this sacred planet, with sacred beings. So how do we respect life? So when Buddha developed his teaching on karma, it was not by speculating, but he was carefully observing his own life, exactly how things worked in his own life. And it's true today. That's how you learn about it. We observe what's happening in our life. The clarity on karma comes from each of us studying, inspecting with focus and clarity exactly how things go for us. How's this going? Where is it landing? Daido Roshi used to say, what you do and what happens to you are the same thing. And for some of us, this koan has lasted a lifetime since we've heard it. What you do and what happens to you are the same thing. So the principle of karma has two parts, the karma of cause and the karma of effect, or the result. So the cause, as Buddha says, is a way of acting and to bring consciousness to consciousness the acts that we create that are unresolved. So the acts that we do that leave a kind of hangover, the feeling that we're doing something that's not kosher, if you could. We're doing something and we could feel it. It's got a hangover. It's not quite kosher. It's continuing to be resolved. So he says, we're like a weather system. It will produce increasing cloudiness of similarly unresolved situations. And he uses the word that haunts this particular relationship and others until we deal with it. So if we feel that weather system, that not so kosher, something's still resolving in our related relationship. According to the teachings we have since beginning, a mass of unresolved karma. No, that doesn't sound like good news, but if we're getting conscious, then we can be at one with it and resolve it. That's the thing. You know, jealousy. I've had that affliction since I can remember nursery school. And I don't know how long it's been going, and I still feel it. And it haunts me. I feel it, make perspectives to really get to, like, what is it? What do I don't feel like I have enough of right now? That I'm jealous, that I can't be happy, and someone else is happy. Not everywhere, but things. There's a certain unresolved hangover that I feel. Some of us, it's being prideful or stingy, whatever. You know, you have to look at what happens that you see repeating. That's a kind of a hangover, and it just doesn't feel right, right? And that's good news, actually. This is all good news. That's why we're practicing. That's why it's called practice, because we want to bring out of the darkness of ignorance our consciousness. And we see this at a large scale right now. You know, the fear of darkness. Darkness is where wisdom is, actually. We're afraid of darkness. And they send you earth a lot about that. Helps us to see that that's where so many nutrients are. Unfinished business created by cause remains in the body. And we experience this as tension. When something's unresolved, we get tense about it, don't you? Like when I feel this jealousy arrive, I know my jaw gets really tight. I can't hear things well. I'm absorbed by this feeling. And so I don't even hear people talking to me when it's activated. I can't even hear what the person's saying in a lot of cases. So these are good clues that something's happening. So we feel it in our body in the form of unacknowledged feelings, emotions, sensations that we might hold at bay. And we get a really tense, finding ourselves resisting our bodies. And then there's this log jam of incomplete experience in our body. I see head shaking. Yep, know that one, the log jam. You know, it just gets really tight. We have ways that we can breathe and like see what's happening. It's like, oh, there you are, coming into consciousness. Out of the dark. Doesn't feel great. Can be discomforting. We may want to run. We may want to perpetuate it because it also can bring a feeling that feels for momentarily good. Like anger can feel super good for a moment. And then the haunt comes. That was not so kosher. That was not so good. How do we find the wisdom in tension? Not in attention, in tension. To not make harm to ourself and others when we're in that, because that's when it happens usually, that in that unawareness of what we're experiencing, that's where we create more harm. That's what I notice at any rate. So we have our zazen, which allows us to take time to learn to slow down, see what's appearing. You know, there's a mantra in somatic experience that says, slow down to go fast. Slow down to experience to go fast. But we just want to go fast. We don't want this there. Get out. Get rid of it. And then to not personally identify and hold space. It's not you. It's not you. This is the karma moving through. There's sensations telling us. Practicing good, kindness, allowing space, allowing them to be seen, allowing what needs to be seen, metabolized, released when ready. Connect with our grounded body, our open heart, and our clear mind. So when we atone at one with, it doesn't mean something just drops off and, I'm at one with it. We have to keep going back again and doing more of this process of allowing it to be seen, metabolized, and released. That's how that at one continues. I love the work of Marion Woodman, a lot of you. She's a Jungian analyst. And she has this quote that I've always loved that says, if we could allow the pace of our meetings to slow down to the pace of our hearts, we might find genuine understanding. Whether that's meeting each other, or situations, ourself. If we could allow the pace of our meeting, whatever we're experiencing, to slow down to the pace of our heart, catch up to it, we might find genuine understanding. And then there's the karma of effect. It's good. As Buddha put it, beings are owners of their actions, heirs of their actions. They originate from their actions, are bound to their actions, have their actions as refuge. It is an action that distinguishes beings as inferior and superior. Contemplate the entire bank of unresolved karma that accompanies us in each moment, recognizing that all this actually is the result of previous actions. The Buddha realized the absolute nature of things, human and non-human, is without this fixed characteristic. And because we have human consciousness, we think, because we have intention in there, not an intender, but an intention, once we see what's emerging, we make decisions, we perceive good and bad, we perceive pain and pleasure for the most part, that everything we do has an effect. So everything that we do, Buddha realized, has a moral quotient for ourselves and others. And he said to begin practicing means to begin by ceasing from evil, from harming. Dogen wrote in an essay on not creating harm. Now stay with it. This is Dogen. He's going to somersault us a bit. If we don't do harm or make harm, it doesn't exist on its own. Okay? If we don't do harm or make harm, it doesn't exist on its own. It takes someone or something to create it. So when the precepts were often referred to as standards for monastic bodhisattvas. And a bodhisattva is a great practitioner walking on the path toward Buddhahood. All of you, all of us, myself, walking on the path to Buddhahood to be a benefit to all beings. And we won't check out until we do that. Every one of them comes through. Every one of them, as well as us. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. It's continuous. And Sangha was a 4th century Mahayana teacher, founder of the Mind Only or Yogacara school, made it clear that a lay bodhisattva path, so your lay practitioners, I'm a monastic, is an essential element of the Mahayana, and that got passed to the Zen tradition. And these three pure precepts were written out as embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, morality. Do not create evil. Embracing and sustaining good qualities. Practicing good. Embracing and sustaining living beings. Actualizing good for others. And lay and monastic bodhisattvas embrace not so much what form our life takes, but are embracing and sustaining the standards of conduct of our particular life role. Letting go of our self-centeredness, which often brings harm to others. So we're encouraged to appreciate the embracing aspect to experience harmony with our actions, embracing our conduct. We're encouraged to do that, embrace it, not push it away. Get rid of it. Where are we going to put it? It's like we put our trash out on the curb, but where's it going? It's not like we get rid of it. It's going somewhere. It has another place it's going, right? She works there. On the receiving end. So, there's a little book by Buddha I have on the Dhammapada I travel with, and in there it said, refrain from harm, do all good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind-wrought. So Dogen transmitted this precept of embrace and sustain standards of conduct, and he wrote an essay, Refrain from All Harm. And he tells the story of this Chinese Zen teacher named Bird's Nest, who was called this because he lived up in a tree. And he was called Bird's Nest. So the story goes, there was a statesman and a poet who was the student of Bird's Nest. And one time the statesman stood below the tree and called up to him and said, looks pretty precarious and dangerous up there. And Bird Nest said down to him, looks pretty precarious and dangerous down there. Indeed, it is precarious and dangerous to actually go about in the world outside of trees. Because it's so easy to get into cause harm and forget about doing good. Once a statesman asked, what is the great meaning of Buddha's teachings? That was always a question in ancient China by a lot of practitioners. And his teacher replied, so what's the great meaning of Buddha's teaching? And the teacher replied, refrain from harm, do all good. And the statesman said, though this is so, even a 3-year-old child can say that. And the teacher said, a 3-year-old child may be able to say it, but an 80-year-old person cannot practice it. And the statesman bowed in thanks to that response. And Dogen comments on this story saying, since the family of Buddhas arises from conditions, Thus, conditions arise from the family of Buddhas. It is not that harm does not exist. It's just that it is not done. And in this writing called Shiwaku Makuso, the characters mean, do not do all harm. But it could also read as, Dogen says, all harm is not done. Harm is not empty. It is not done. Harm is not form. It is not done. Harm is not not done. It is just not done. I know you'll have to take that little strip home. But these are, the Dharma's not easy, right? We have to stretch a bit. It's not to twist us up and say, oh, this is just hogwash. You know, we have to sit with it. We have to work with these words to see the great reality that's being shown to us. Seeing it is not substantial and not denying what is here. We need both legs. That something is not substantial, and yet here it is. Here's the situation. This is what's arising, just this. Otherwise, it's one-sided. Dogen says, ceasing from evil is the abiding place of all Buddhas. This abiding place is the state of non-duality, of not knowing and non-separation. The sixth ancestor defines Zazen as the state of mind in which there is no separation between subject and object, no space between you and me, or all the space, up and down, right and wrong, being open to all the ways of our lives and not having an answer. The flowering of Zazen is doing good for others, Dogen says. This is to transcend the profane and to be beyond the holy. This is to liberate oneself and others. I love that the word Buddha is related to the English word bud, a flower's awakening or opening. We could say the bud away. The bud away is unattainable. The blossoming, the fruitful practice field where we can practice all of it. Budding, fruitful, blossoming. How do we lead ourselves? That's the question. To lead ourselves, to lead the people. Let harmony pervade everywhere. We can do this. This is how we heal and bloom, the living as we are serving within the intimate web of our collective beingness. And I'd like to, since we have a short amount of time, this was an essay that somebody passed to me this week called Your Sacredness by Jaya John. Your sacredness. The ancient one spoke with a depth of prayer. Something immeasurably divine, sacred, and miraculous is happening now. You are happening. You are alive. Life comes down to two questions. What do you consider sacred? And how do you treat your sacred things? You are a sacred land. This means everything. People cannot treat you however they wish, nor can you treat yourself according to any impulse or mood. You are a place where ancestors rest and ceremonies are performed. You are sacred water, fire, sky, earth. The first act in a beautiful life is to recognize the truth of who you are. You are sacredness. As long as you stay in this truth, you may have your beautiful life. This world will often act to persuade you otherwise. It will whisper and shout that you are not sacred, that you are less than that. Your entire life is soulful struggle, your sacredness in it. You are a salmon swimming upstream against a degrading current that wants your soul. You were born to swim upstream to spawn beauty in your life and feed generations their own chance to live. Always upstream against a current. This can be hard. It can be the sweetest journey. Our great misunderstanding is that we believe some things are meant to be done soullessly and other things soulfully. Gradually, more and more we live soullessly, believing it to be an easier way. Nothing is meant to be lived soullessly. All has the Buddha nature. Ease has nothing to do with it. You are a soulful thing. Live soulfully. Live the way of the Buddha.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.